So, welcome to the Buddha Loka. And now this morning, I thought to, I'll chant the, let's see, put that. I'll chant a gatha for you and we'll see if you recognize what the theme will be today. See if you recognize this one. And this is in the Pali language, the language that the Buddhist suttas in the Theravada tradition they were recorded in, and probably quite close to the language of the Buddha. Na banje papa ke mite, na banje purisa dhamme, banjeta mite kalyane, banjeta purisuttame. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Now, does anybody recognize that Pali gatha? There's some Pali students here. No? He got it in one, Raji. That's it exactly. Very good. Yes, no, that was very close. You heard the kalyana. So that's because we have, don't we, the meaning, we have this word the Buddha used for himself, kalyana mitta. And this is a spiritual friend or a spiritual guide. It's quite a nice term, actually. And I'll give you the translation because it's exactly what you're saying. And this is from the Dhammapada. I'm sure many people will know this verse when I translate it. And it says, do not associate with bad friends. That's the papake mite. Mite is a friend. Do not associate with low friends. Associate with virtuous friends. Associate with the highest or the noble friends. So that's the translation of that verse. So this is all about, you know, spiritual friends. And so I thought this would be a really good subject to speak about. It's an important subject. The Buddha said that, and I'll mention it later, the whole of the spiritual life is actually spiritual friends and spiritual guides. Because they set us on the path, or they encourage us to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is really important. So he's not saying it's half the holy life, as Venerable Ananda said. He said it's all of the holy life. So these spiritual friends, they're really like our role models, and they give us lived example of qualities that we can develop. So this is what I will talk about today. And of course, the kalyana mitta usually is translated in English as the good friend, but in English, good friend has a lot of meanings. And a good friend's not always a virtuous person. It could be your drinking mate is a good friend, or somebody that you go to the races with is a good friend, or whatever. So I prefer, you know, spiritual friend, because it makes it clear. And in actual fact, that's one of the translations that the most recent Pali dictionary does give, spiritual guide or spiritual friend. So it's also related, kalyana is related to beautiful as well, because these good qualities, this virtue, are beautiful. But also it's used in terms of physical appearance. So they have, in Pali, they have terms like the most beautiful girl in the country. I was trying to check up the Pali, that's kalyana something or other. The most beautiful girl in the country, they mention. So I was thinking, well, what, for most people, what is, and it's a very topical thing, spiritual friendship, kalyana mitta, because often we see this idea of the guru, don't we? We see it in different traditions. It's more in the Tibetan tradition. It certainly comes from the Hindu tradition, the idea of a guru. This is somebody that one totally obeys, that's the idea anyway, and they have this what we call love, devotion and surrender, I think was one of the songs that I remember from my youth, which is sort of on the theme of the guru. And the guru is seen to be an emanation of the Buddha, of God. And so this is a sort of teaching, this sort of an approach that the Buddha did not encourage. He did not encourage the idea of the guru, because people blindly believe in a guru. And we can see, we've seen some stunning examples in modern times, haven't we, of gurus who have gone off the rails. And we've had an example here in Melbourne, I think, recently, with that yoga guru in Mount Eliza, I think it was, who's, you know, who's what his behaviour is being brought up in the press. So, and it's important that this a guru is not something, we understand that guru is not something the Buddha encouraged, because always the Buddha's teaching, isn't it? It's about wisdom. Blind faith doesn't really have a part to play in the Buddha's teaching. It always has to be balanced with wisdom, understanding. And the point of a Kalyana Mitta is someone who can give guidance, you know, give us an example, as I said before, become a role model for us. Because often, you know, when we read these things in the suttas, you know, the words are one thing, you know, but the actual lived experience can be quite different. So, you know, for instance, we can read the word anger, and we just read anger. But when we see it in life, we really get the full power of it. It's the same with metta. When you read the word metta, it's just a word, and those words we chanted from the Metta Sutta are words, but it's the feeling of metta, this incredible feeling of friendliness, of wishing well-being to oneself and others. This is what we're aiming at. So this is where they give guidance, and very much, particularly in a monastic setting, Kalyanamitta is there, they teach in order to inspire, to encourage, and they give spiritual advice. That's what they do with their teaching. But there is another agenda with it, and this is the most important aspect of it, actually, is what we call the training. And you might have seen that in the Itipiso, training, taming those that are capable of training or taming. And this is going against our defilements, the negative aspects of our character, which everyone has that's not enlightened. And this, of course, is desire, aversion and delusion. We all have those qualities. An enlightened being, of course, they abandon all of those. They see through them. So this training is very important. Of course, a big part of the training is precepts, you know, it's a sila, the virtue. And this is something we take on individually. But it's very good if we see somebody who's an exponent of it, who's actually living it. And that really can encourage us, actually. And they also, this is the hard bit, they can also, if we have faith in that person, they can also point out things to us that are failings in ourselves that would be good to know. And in the Dhammapada, people will know this, and the Buddha mentions that we should regard someone who points out our faults like someone who is pointing out a treasure. But he says, the next line down, it's the wise that are pointing out our faults, pointing out those things, those shortcomings in ourselves. It's not foolish people. Many people will criticise us, put us down and so forth, but they may not be wise people. And of course, that's a very important consideration. So when we have this faith in a Kalyana Mitta, a spiritual friend, then we're open to them saying, look, you know, this area, you know, you could look at. And this means that we can develop, we can grow. Because we all of us need a mirror. It's often easier for other people to see our shortcomings than ourselves, isn't it? And so this is what a spiritual friend does. They're a mirror. And some of them, you know, extraordinarily good mirrors. Like Ajahn Chah, for instance, this is the Thai meditation master who passed away in 1992, and he could mirror back things to people. So that would be really quite a teaching to them, just in his actions and everything, so that they would soon get the message. But it's important that we have that inspiration, as I say, from the teaching, in order that we undertake the training. And this is, the training is the hard work, really, because our defilements are what give us this grief in life, what makes life difficult. And of course, there are many different types of kalyana mittas, and I think it's good to be open to seeing many people, many different people in our lives as teaching us something. So of course the Buddha and enlightened monks and nuns, enlightened people, they are the supreme kalyana mittas. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. And then there are Dhamma teachers who may or may not be enlightened. That's a very important consideration. And but we can connect with them, because sometimes people, they read the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, and they can't quite connect to it because it's not a lived example. And then they can meet a teacher who can explain it and who can give them the meaning behind it. And so this is very important for us. And these days we're very lucky because we have the internet, like today, then YouTube and Zoom, of course, we're all Zoom these days. And we have books and recordings, videos, all this sort of thing. And we can meet kalyana mittas in this way. And this is a source of developing our practice by our connecting with a teacher. Because we will find, won't we, you know, some teachers we can really relate to, we can connect with. Other teachers, well, not so much. And it's those ones that we connect with that we can actually develop our practice from. But of course, in a Buddhist context, you know, also our kalyana mittas can be, you know, parents can be, our school teachers, you know, even friends, employers, ourselves. Sometimes we are, ultimately, we have to be our own kalyana mitta, spiritual guide. But it's good when we have, you know, a very good, clear understanding of the path, of the Noble Eightfold Path, very clear understanding of right view, then we can really be a spiritual friend to ourselves. We have both the qualities of the foolish person and the wise person in us. They're both there, so we can develop them. So we have to eventually be, you know, our own spiritual guides. And of course, for the Buddha, the first stage of enlightenment, this is Sotapanna or Soan in Sinhala. That's when, the Buddha says, one becomes independent in his teachings. Independent in the sense that they now know for themselves experientially what the path is. And they know, they've seen it for themselves. They don't need a guide, but of course they can always benefit from a guide like the Buddha or someone that's further along that path. So that's when we become really independent. That's when we become, according to the Buddha, learners, seekers, first stage of enlightenment. Before that, we're not even learners. We're in kindergarten. So it's quite sobering when you think of it like that. But in many ways, life is teaching us. And you can see, I know that Ajahn Chah had this teaching, which I love, is that everything is teaching us. Everything is teaching us. And I often mention the story of Ajahn Jagaro, who was the founder of the Bodhinyana Buddhist Monastery, where Ajahn Brahm is, and who was a teacher here, and who disrobed in 95, I think it was. But he, when his early days in Thailand, he was staying with Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah sent him to a monastery, a small monastery in the back of beyond, and he went. And it was very few monks, there wasn't a teacher there. And so when Ajahn Chah came for a visit, he complained, there's no teacher here. How can I, you know, develop? How can I grow? There's no kalyana mitta. And he said, Ajahn Chah said, you've got six teachers here. And Ajahn Jagaro, who said, what, six teachers? And he said, yes, you've got sight, smells, tastes, touches, and the mind. But he added then, you have to be a good student to learn. You have to be a good student. So this is, life is actually teaching us. And if we have that attitude, we can learn from a lot of people and learn, you know, good I mean, many people have good qualities that we can learn about, whether it be generosity, kindness. Sometimes people are amazingly patient. That can be something that is very good to have an example of it, because today, of course, we're all in such a rush to come across a patient person and see how they manage it, you know, how they embody it. That's very useful for us. So I was just going to mention, give a quotation from the Buddha about, oh yes, this is the point. So why are spiritual friends so important? Why do you think the Buddha emphasize spiritual friends so much? He's saying it's the whole of the holy life, not just a bit, everything. So I'll give you the answer anyway. I'll give a quote from the Buddha, and he says, monks, I do not see even a single thing that so causes unarisen wholesome qualities to arise and arisen unwholesome qualities to decline as good friendship, spiritual friendship. For one with good friends or spiritual friends, unarisen, unwholesome qualities arise and arisen, unwholesome qualities decline. So this, of course, is, you know, the Buddha's definition of progress on this path. And this is how we can actually see in our lives whether we're growing in the path. It's not a matter of whether our mindfulness is continuous, or we've established, we've got jhanas, or we've got this wisdom or that, this insight or that insight. It's whether this good qualities are growing in us or not. You know, this is a real, to me, the real test actually of a practitioner, because we won't be able to tell whether necessarily they've got good meditation or insights. We won't know. But so one of the reasons that Kalyanamitta is so important, the spiritual friend is so important, is that we are, even though most of us don't think this, we're conditioned, affected by the company we keep. And this is, I mean, most people say, well, you know, to a degree, but we really do. We take up so much from those that we associate with. And many of us think, you know, well, we're making up our own mind, you know, and we choose and this sort of thing. But you see the power of advertising, for instance, so much for us choosing, all these fashions that we take on, all these sort of appearances that are now the current way to look, etc. So we realise that there's a lot of brainwashing going on out there. This is a term Ajahn Brahm uses. It can be positive or negative. He uses it in a funny sense, but it is what's happening. We're actually being conditioned by the people we associate with, by the things we encounter on the media, wherever we, whatever we read and see. And we're being, of course, we've conditioned in this life very much by our parents, our schooling, the culture we live in. It's very good if you live in a different culture from the one that you are brought up in. It really makes you aware of how much of our conditioning comes from that culture. You know, how much the food we like and all these things, you know, come from our upbringing. So this is very important for us to understand. That's why a spiritual friend is so important. You know, we're choosing the sort of conditioning, the sort of views that we're going to take on board. And this is really important for developing the path. So, you know, for us, the Buddha and his teachings are a conditioning that we are developing by understanding, by practicing. But very importantly, you know, for us, is that the Buddha says this is the way that we can develop, become a stream enterer, the first stage of enlightenment. One part of it is yoniso manasikara, so that insight that goes back to the causes and conditions in situations, in mind, in this body. But also, very importantly, and this is one that Ajahn Brahm emphasizes, the words of another, paratagosa. He often emphasized this needs to be someone who has seen the Dhamma, a noble person, in order to transmit it. And it's like, if we want to go somewhere, do we ask somebody who's never been there? No, we ask someone who's been there. Usually we ask Google these days. Don't we ask Google? But Google's everywhere. So this is the point. You know, someone who has started on that path or traveled to the end of that path can tell us, can give us good directions. So this can actually speed up our development and as it were, then we can head in the right direction. Until we actually get to the first stage of enlightenment, we're wandering all over the place, thinking this is the way, that is the way, this technique is the way, you know, that teacher is the way. Of course, the teacher is the Buddha. So these are the things that we see. And we see, you know, you can see it with your friends and you can see it in society. It's easier to see with other people. One of the big things that parents worry about is the company their children keep. You know, and it is very, very true, you know, that the company we keep affects, you know, the way we develop. And I know for parents, they worry, you know, they worry that their children, if they have bad friends who are taking them in a direction of, say, drugs, alcohol, all these sorts of things, they worry about that. And that's very, very important to realise. We are affected by the people that we associate with. And in English, we have the saying, birds of a feather flock together. And so it's good if we develop friendships with people who have got virtue, who have got kindness, who have got good qualities, and do not, you know, take up with people who may be fun to be with, but maybe not so good. It's difficult when you're younger because, you know, your friends, the way you look at your friends is quite different. You're not so, you know, you meet them, say, at school or at high school, university, wherever. And so you tend to go along with the group. We call this peer group pressure. So this can be something that we need to be a bit selective about. And even in the time of the Buddha, you can see that the various types of monks associated with particular types of monks. So, for instance, Devadatta, Venerable Devadatta, who was tried to kill the Buddha and created a schism in the Sangha, there were certain monks who were attracted to him, and they were together. Then there were certain monks who had qualities like Venerable Ananda. Venerable Ananda was a very amiable, you know, very friendly sort of monk and good with people. And then there were certain monks who were attracted to Venerable Mahakasapa, and he was like this very austere, very, very austere person. And they liked that style. They were attracted. Their characters were of a similar nature, actually. And Venerable Mahamoggallana, of course, you know, psychic powers, very deep meditation. And Venerable Sariputta, monks who were particularly drawn to wisdom, to analytical approach to the Dhamma, they were drawn to him. So these spiritual friends, you know, are the ones that we can learn from and the ones that will help with our, as it were, reconditioning this mind from its, you know, its journey through countless lives. And they, as I say, they give advice and they're a role model. And we develop faith and confidence. It's really important because, you know, faith is not a word that people take too much, but confidence is. And it's so important because it's only what we have faith in, only what we have confidence in, that we'll develop energy to actually do, to put into practice. If we don't have confidence in something, if we don't have faith in something, we won't put it into practice. And of course, this is most crippling for ourselves. We don't have faith and confidence in ourselves. That's a really a factor that can really affect our progress altogether. So this faith and confidence can come from a spiritual friend, and it gives us the energy to practice. And of course, that's to develop the Noble Eightfold Path. And I mentioned, of course, that the Buddha mentions that the spiritual friend is the whole of the holy life, not half, whole. But I always like to ask people, what do you think the other half was? That Venerable Ananda said that that a spiritual friend, a spiritual guide, was half the holy life. And the Buddha said, no, Ananda, it is not so, it's a whole. So what's the other half that Venerable Ananda was thinking of? Do you have any ideas? It's a good, I thought it was quite good, actually. I sort of think, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's Langdon, that's close to it. Energy. This is what Venerable Ananda was thinking of, you know, this really strong energy to practice. Yeah, that's it. And then, so one of the important things I was going to talk about, there's a few important things, is what qualities do we need to meet a spiritual friend? Often we look at the qualities of a spiritual friend, and I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. But what qualities do we need to meet a spiritual friend? And I think it very much relates, doesn't it, to that idea. You hear that saying, don't you? When the student is ready, the teacher will appear or appears. And that's actually true in life. When we are open to a situation, we can come upon a situation where we see things completely differently, and we can meet somebody that can help that process. So this is how do we have that readiness? How do we have that readiness to meet a spiritual friend? I know one of the big motivators for meeting a spiritual friend is usually, unfortunately, dukkha, suffering in our life, difficulties in our lives. You know, and I know for myself, you know, when my father passed away, suddenly had a heart attack at 66, was just sitting on the bed giving a cup of tea to my mother and then gone. And that was a real shock to me, actually. It was a real shock. It was quite extraordinary because none of us, a shock to the whole family at that time. But the result of that, and this happens quite common, is a quite common experience for people after they've lost someone that's so central to their life, a lot of growth. And that's when I started, you know, becoming interested in Buddhism. And I had already been interested in Buddhism, but my commitment to it really strengthened, because I could see it's an example of old age, sickness and death. And at a deep level, it told me what's important. The mind, developing the mind. So that was dukkha is always a very good motivator, not pleasant, but a good motivator for us. But of course, you know, one of the qualities we need to meet a spiritual friend is openness to learning. You may think that that's obvious, but I think we come with so many views and opinions that oftentimes we are like full up with our views and opinions, so we can't, you know, take anything new on board. So this is important. It doesn't mean we should be gullible. I think that's very important to say. We use our own wisdom, of course, but we have to have a certain openness and a certain humbleness that we may be able to learn something from this person. We may not, but we have this humbleness that we may. Because sometimes our pride, our sense of ourselves, doesn't allow us to be humble. We think we know the answers already. But one of the very good things about these Kalyanamittas is they cut through a lot of those views by just being the way they are. And you recognise this, but wow, they're different. And that attracts you, no matter what your views are. You think, wow, they're different. And this is more on the intuitive, the feeling level, isn't it? So that cuts through a lot of that. But of course, another condition we need is that respect, and that comes from humbleness too. You know, respect the person's good qualities that they have. And particularly, you know, in a spiritual friend, their ethical qualities are very important. That's the base, the foundation. Do they have integrity or not? Are they practicing what they preach? That's what we usually say, isn't it? Are they practicing what they preach? So, and also to be open to developing confidence and faith. You know, this is something that encourages our growth. If we have that, The Buddha calls it an indriya, a faculty of confidence or faith, giving us the energy to develop wirya, we call it, energy to practice. And of course, one of the big things that's important for meeting a Kalyanamitta is really an interest in finding out, interest in understanding things, having this sort of investigative mind. And for us, you know, our question is much more important, actually, even than the answer. So these are the questions that drive us in life can bring us to a Kalyanamitta, somebody that seems to be possibly, you know, able to help us with the question that's so important in our life, whatever that question is. And it's always, that's a motivating factor. And it's so important for our practice to have these questions and have that sincere interest in what we're experiencing in this body and mind, and to find out for ourselves. Because the Buddha's teaching is not about just believe in me and everything will be okay. Sounds nice, doesn't it? Many people like that idea. But, of course, it's about direct experience for ourselves, really understanding for ourselves. So this is what the Buddha is encouraging. So when we have these qualities, we are, as it were, ready to meet a Kalyanamitta. If we have experienced dukkha, we're open, we're humble, and we're respectful. We're ready to develop faith and confidence. And we've got an interest. We've got questions that we are asking. So that's... But at the same time, as I mentioned, we shouldn't be gullible. And it's very important that we check up with Kalyanamittas. Sometimes I think people feel, oh, it's you know, maybe bad karma to actually check up on a teacher, you know, whether they are, you know, worthy of being a Kalyanamitta. But I always say to people, you know, the Buddha, in his teachings, in the Majjhima Nikaya, he gave a whole teaching on how you can investigate himself, whether the Buddha, the Tathagata, is really fully enlightened. He gives a whole sutta, a whole teaching. It's called the Inquirer or the Vimamsa Sutta. So you can see that, you know, the Buddha is encouraging it. So for other teachers, we can check up. And of course, how do we check up? And this is very important these days because we have the internet, we have YouTube, and there's a lot out there that is, I get these wonderful, somebody in Sri Lanka, they send me these videos every day, actually, of Buddha quotes, and 99% of them, fake. Some of them, good meaning. I thought, well, the Buddha might have thought that. Yes, he would agree with that. He wouldn't disagree with it, but fake. So very important we check up with I haven't actually told her, you know, these are mainly fake, you know. Buddha never said this. Because people, it's like product endorsement, you know. People just put the Buddha's name on all these, whatever they want to sell, whatever they think's good. And some of them are quite dodgy, actually, you know, talking about God and all these sorts of things. And I thought, wow, Buddha would never have said that. So the Buddha encouraged us to check up using his teachings. Using the teachings and also the discipline, you know, the precepts, the rules that we keep. And of course, before he passed into Parinibbana, passed away, he said to, in the Parinibbana Sutta, to check, you know, if somebody says this is the teaching of the Buddha, just check up with the existing teachings and the existing discipline. And of course, you know, the Buddha encourages us to look, to investigate in the Kalama Sutta, to investigate what is wholesome and what is unwholesome and what is the experience we have from that. You know, if we have these negative emotions arising of desire, aversion and delusion, what's the experience of that? Is pleasant, unpleasant? Is it beneficial, unbeneficial? Of course, you know, the negative, the unwholesome always is pretty unbeneficial, doesn't lead to happiness and well-being. So we use our experience too and our intuition to investigate whether a person, you know, whether it is actually leading to our benefit or not. We can tell that within ourselves. And so now I'd like to talk about how we can identify a spiritual friend. And I'll give a lived example in a minute. This is a bit that I like the most, actually, because guess who? I'll give... So a spiritual friend is anyone who is really on the spirit, on the Noble Eightfold Path, even if they haven't reached a stage of enlightenment, if they have an understanding, they have developed qualities that we find we need to develop, this can be helpful for us. And this is something Ayakema used to emphasize. You know, we can learn from somebody that's practiced more, has developed more peace in their lives, more kindness, more generosity, these qualities. But of course, the Buddha is the best example of the Kalyanamitta, isn't he? And the reason for that, you know, the highest sort of Kalyanamitta, spiritual friend, is someone, and this is what the Buddha said, who is free of greed, hatred and delusion, freed of desire, aversion and delusion. And he mentions this in the Dajagga Sutta, you know, that he has these qualities. And that sort of person is worthy of being a refuge. It's a spiritual friend, but someone you can really trust. Because, you know, they're not going to be, their behaviour, their speech is not going to be undermined by desire, hatred, by fear, by delusion. It's not going to be there. They can be there for you 100%. So the Buddha is the best example for us. And interestingly enough, you know, he says the reason for a Buddha or an Arahant to exist is just compassion, because they've finished the job. They're just waiting. They use this phrase, waiting, like a worker waiting for their wages, that's all. That's how they describe somebody who's enlightened in this life, and they're waiting for the body and the mind to pass away. So the Buddha said there were two reasons that he taught, and that was to be an example, just like a role model for future generations, and also out of compassion for future generations. And he meditated. He didn't need to meditate, but he meditated as an example, out of compassion. And he said it was also a pleasant abiding for him, you know, when he was meditating, very pleasant for him. And so the Buddha had this enormous compassion, not only on the level of the spiritual, he also did on the physical. Because we hear about, you know, one time the Buddha was going around one of the monasteries, maybe Jeta one, with Venerable Ananda, and they came across a monk who had dysentery, so he was really, really sick. And nobody was looking after him. And so the Buddha and Venerable Ananda washed this monk and took care of him. And then the Buddha called the Sangha together and said, why are you not looking after this monk? You do not have mothers and fathers to look after you, families to look after you. You must look after your brothers in the holy life, or your sisters if you're a nun, in the holy life. So he taught them that, and this was on a physical level too. So he was doing, because one of the jobs of a teacher in the monastic tradition anyway is the spiritual welfare, but also the physical. They've got to look after this student, make sure they've got enough food, clothes, medicine, etc. But there's a nice quote that I'll mention just before I get to the last section, where the Buddha says, and this is in that same sutta about the holy life, being the whole, the spiritual friend being the whole of the holy life. By relying upon me, this is a Buddha, as a good friend or a spiritual friend, Ananda, beings subject to birth, aging or old age, illness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure and despair are freed from them. It is in this way, Ananda, that a monk or nun who has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is what the Buddha is as a spiritual friend. He's helping us develop the Noble Eightfold Path out of this enormous compassion. And so I thought I'd talk about a lived example of the seven qualities that someone qualify someone to be a spiritual friend. This is from a sutta in the numerical discourses. This is the Anguttara Nikaya in the Book of the Sevens, of course, seven. And it's one of the suttas on a friend. It's sutta number 36 on a friend. And here the Buddha mentions, monks. One should associate with a monk friend, or we could say for nun friend, who possesses seven qualities. One should resort to him or her and attend on him or her, even if they dismiss you. What seven? And these are the seven qualities that he mentions about a Kalyanamitta. And these, they're quite interesting, actually, listings. They may not be quite what you think, what you'd think the qualities would be. And the first one, and it's quite probably the order this is given in is usually important. You know, the first quality is very important. So here it says, this monk friend or nun friend should be a pleasing and agreeable, pleasing and agreeable. So I thought, who could I use for an example? I thought, Ajahn Brahm. So I thought I'd look at Ajahn Brahm as a spiritual friend. This is the part that I like the best, actually. And of course, I think most of you know Ajahn Brahm. Do you think he's pleasing and agreeable? I think very few people would say, no, he's not pleasing, he's not agreeable. They may not like the jokes. His character might not appeal to everyone. But it is important that they are pleasing and agreeable, because this is what draws students to a teacher, but also gives them a sense of safety and that the teacher has their interests at heart. And I know, you know, for me, with Ajahn Brahm, for instance, one of the things that is so attractive, so pleasing and agreeable, is his smile. Do you notice that? He's got a fantastic smile. Very rarely do you can get, I see lots of pictures of myself and think, wow. But his pictures with a smile, fantastic, really. I just connect with them very much. They're wonderful. And they come from, for me, you know, one of the qualities I see in Ajahn Brahm is this naturalness. And I think the naturalness comes from mindfulness. You're here in the moment, just natural, simple, not imposing a lot of concepts on the present moment. And that smile, is really, for me, is infectious. You know, it really transmits. So I have in my hut, I have one of the photos on the coronavirus book, which this great smile I really like. And of course for me, and I think most people, when somebody smiles, it puts you at ease. You feel safe. It feels good. And it's interesting that Ajahn Brahm himself mentions, why did he ordain in the Thai tradition? And his answer was, it's quite surprising, because when he went to the various temples in London, the Buddhist temples, you know, the Burmese, Sri Lankan, and the Thai, probably others too, actually, he said, the Thai monks, they smiled the most. So that's why he ordained in Thailand, and very, very fortunately for him too. He had that connection, obviously, with Ajahn Chah. But one of the things you see that's pleasing and agreeable to some, at least, is his humour. His humour is a very, is one of the strong qualities he has. And if you notice with humour, if it connects with you, sometimes humour doesn't connect with you, immediately you relax. It changes the mind state that you may have. It cuts across so much stuff when you connect with humour, especially if it's, you know, wholesome sort of humour and not too dark and negative. There's some very dark and negative sort of jokes and so on. But it really cuts through a lot of mind state. So it's a very skillful way to get people's attention and to focus them here and now and to listen. But of course, one of the other characteristics that's pleasing and agreeable, and I think most people would agree, very, very kind. His kindness is very, very strong. This is, of course, we say metta in the Pali. We call it metta. And one of the aspects of that to me, which is very strong, I see it over the years and years of knowing Ajahn Brahm, is this desire to serve, to help. And it's such a strong quality in him. And this comes from that sense of taking care of people and compassion. And he's so prepared to give time to people. And I remember a talk here that Venerable Chikwang Sunim gave. I think she was talking about bodhisattvas. And she said, the best example of the bodhisattva, Ajahn Brahm. She said, I live in a remote place, on a hill, you know, out of the way. But he gives 24/7 almost. He's incredible. He's got so much energy for it as well. And I think one another quality that's very pleasing and agreeable is he's so optimistic and positive. You know, many people will find that very attractive. And one thing we can see very much, and I think this is something you have to be wary of too, and I think people would agree, oodles of charisma. He's got just like a magnet. It's incredible. And I remember, actually, it was quite interesting. I remember in, because I was lived in Western Australia and I'd become a Buddhist in 1983, and I'd been exposed to Ajahn Jagra's teachings, Ajahn Brahm's teachings. And I was very impressed with Ajahn Jagra's teachings, not Ajahn Brahm so much at that stage. And, you know, he was good, he was sort of fine. He wasn't the Ajahn Brahm we know today. And then he came here to the Buddhist Society because I'd moved to Victoria in Melbourne in 1992, I think it was. And he came here in 93 and he gave this talk. And I thought, my goodness, what's happened to him? He's got oodles of charisma. And what he was saying was really fascinating. He was talking about negative emotions. I thought, wow, what happened to him? So he developed these qualities, you know. So it's incredible. So this is part of, you know, this charisma. It can be a dangerous thing too. Of course, you've got to watch out. There are a lot of people with charisma who are not necessarily virtuous. So very good. I better move along though. And the second quality that the Buddha mentions, I might go through this briefly, is the person is respected. So this is a Kalyanamitta. In order to be a Kalyanamitta, they're a respected person. And of course, Ajahn Brahm has got a lot of respect for his sila, for his morality, his virtue. He's got a lot of respect for his meditation, particularly jhanas, and for his wisdom. And of course, one of the things I often said about the Buddha, it was that he's respected by those who are worthy of respect. So like, he's the teacher's teacher, that saying, isn't it really? The Buddha is worthy of the respect of those that are respected. And of course, Ajahn Brahm is like that too. Many people who are teachers, who are well-respected, respect him too. And the third quality is he's esteemed. It's a bit close to respected, isn't it, really, esteemed? I found that hard to distinguish. And, of course, it's many of the same qualities, but particularly, you know, his understanding of the monks and nuns' discipline. This is called the Vinaya. He's actually like an expert on that from his early days. But particularly he's esteemed for his meditation, isn't he? His meditation and jhana practice is one of the things that he really teaches and encourages. And he mentions in talks, actually, that this started, you know, the teaching about jhanas, which is very well known these days, was inspired by Ayakema when she came to his monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery, in 1991, I think it was, and gave a talk on the jhanas at Bodhinyana Monastery. And she was really encouraging, teaching the jhanas to people. And that inspired Ajahn Brahm, actually, to think, yeah, this is an important thing to teach. And so he has focused on that, being part of his practice. And also he's esteemed, I would say, for his incredible dedication and energy. And that is a teaching in itself, because he gives, definitely, he's wholehearted. I don't think people could say otherwise, and he gives 100% to it, absolutely. And of course we see, you know, in a worldly sense, you know, the things that he has achieved in Western Australia, even here, actually it's beginning to be obvious, building up the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, developing Bodhinyana Monastery, it was established by Ajahn Jagra, supporting the establishment, really inspiring, at the Dhammasara Nuns Monastery in Western Australia, establishing Jhana Grove Meditation Centre just down the road from the monastery, and also being such an important teacher here, a guide here, an advisor here, spiritual advisor we call him. So he's a Kalyanamitta. And also supporting the development of Newbury Buddhist Monastery in a big way, big way. The fourth quality, there we are, important call. A fourth quality that a Kalyanamitta should have is they should be a speaker. And this is someone who can really communicate, and for sure, who is very good at Ajahn. Ajahn Brahm is a really gifted communicator, so quick-witted. He can come back with a one-liner just straight away. It's amazing. And they're very often very funny, always memorable, or usually memorable, and often wise. So he's very, as a speaker, he engages the audience. They're not going to drift off. Sri Lanka, we often have the phenomena at Bunners that people, they'll listen to a Dhamma teaching within moments. You get a very restful time. Very restful time. But I never see that with Ajahn Brahm. And he really needs that humour on a Friday night when he gives his talks on Friday nights. That's more the introductory type of talks for people new to Buddhism. But it's also when people are so tired. I see them, you know, and I think, God, they're really tired. They'll drop off at during the meditation, they probably drop off a lot and then wake up a bit after it. But the humour really keeps them going, actually. So he can speak at different levels for different people. And sometimes I think people who only listen to those Friday night talks might think that's, it's very, superficial or whatever. But he gives that deeper teachings at the monastery and on retreats. And most people here have probably heard some of those teachings. So I was going to give you an example of his... I spent a day with him in Colombo when he was visiting in 2014. It was a Posam Poya, a very important day in Sri Lanka. And I couldn't believe what he could do in a day. It was amazing and different for different occasions. You know, like he gave him a talk to some CEOs, hardly a Buddhist term in there, because they were a mixed group, Muslims, Christians and so on. And then he'd given a TV talk, he'd given before that, which would have been on the Buddhist channel, so it was very, it was a lot of Buddhist terminology, very Buddhist context. And then in the afternoon, he did more TV interviews, and then he went to a very major temple, Dhammayatana in Maharagama, where they have, say, 50,000 people. And there's a Sunday school, Sunday Dhamma school going on. So he goes there and he talks, and they said, can you speak to the kids? And so he goes there and he talks to them about cricket and everything. And then he goes next door and gives this big Dhamma teaching to thousands, because this place, as I say, can get up to 50,000 people. It's just amazing to watch him, teach. Because we hardly ever see that, because the monks at the monastery, because he doesn't travel with it. We don't travel with him. Because he says, if he travels with any of the monks, he has to look after them as well as himself. So probably true. So very good. And the number five, we're getting towards the end, actually, it's about time. This person patiently endures being spoken to. And I think Ajahn Brahm's had a good deal of that. And of course, he often receives criticism because he's such a public figure. Some people like him, some people won't. Some people may disagree with his teachings on Dhamma and so on. And of course, he had a lot of flack, you might say, over the bhikkhuni ordinations in 2009. Did he ever? But I'm very impressed with him because he doesn't hold on to the resentment. At least he says he would be happy for some of those people who were criticising him at that time to come to the monastery. He has no problem. I'd like to see if that worked out in reality, but that's what he says, so that's great. So it's important for all of us that we don't hang on to these negative criticisms, that we can endure. This is like Kanti, we can endure being criticised. It's really being spoken about and negatively in a personal sense. That's what really challenges us. So that's number five. And number six is he gives, or the person, a monk or a nun, gives deep talks. And I think most people would not find that hard to believe with Ajahn Brahm. He gives outstanding talks on jhanas, anatta particularly, it's non-self, on emptiness, dependent origination. This is Paticca-samuppada, stages of awakening. So I mean, it's very, his deep teachings are incredibly satisfying for people who are ready for them. For beginners, maybe too deep. But he's got the Friday night talks for the beginners, so that's good. And the seventh quality, where I'll finish off, and this is very important for a spiritual friend, and this is one of the ways we can check up too on somebody if they are really a spiritual friend. They do not encourage one to do what is wrong. So if you find some of these gurus encouraging sexual relationships with that guru in particular and so on, you can think, no, this is not somebody who is encouraging me to do, this is someone who is encouraging me to do something which is wrong. And so Ajahn Brahm is a very good example of someone who doesn't encourage that. He encourages a lot of independent thinking, actually, in the monastery. It's one of the things I really like about Ajahn Brahm, that he never... Some teachers, it's very much, they'll say, my way or the highway. If you don't like what I do, just go. He's never like that, which is wonderful, and to have that openness. And he never says, you have to practice my technique. Or, you know, forget about it. Why bother to be here? He never says that. And I know as a young monk, I practiced a lot of different techniques and investigated, tried them on for size, and that was very valuable. So he's really very open, but he's a good example to us, actually, of somebody who has got good morality, good virtue. And he's not only teaching it as, you know, teaching it, he's actually an example of it. He's living it. So this is so important. Sometimes teachers can say one thing and do another. And of course, and the Buddha mentions in his teaching, this is like somebody who is benefiting others, but not themselves, because they're not practicing what they preach. But the other thing he teaches us, of course, very big time, actually, is right view. And of course, the important part of right view for me is just knowing good from bad, knowing where that good and bad are coming from. It sounds so elementary, but if you read the news, if you look at the world, I don't think people know what is good and bad. So this is so important for the path. And even though we've had a lot of disharmony over the bhikkhuni ordination, he's one that stresses and emphasizes harmony in the Sangha, harmony in the Buddhist community, and harmony in the wider community. He really does. It's a big emphasis. And so I'd like to finish with the summary the Buddha gives on that sutta of the seven qualities that qualify a person to be a Kalyanamitta. And it's in he or she is dear, respected and esteemed, a speaker and one who endures speech. They give deep Dhamma talks and do not encourage one to do what is wrong. The person here in whom these qualities are found is a friend, benevolent and compassionate. Even if one is dismissed by them, one desiring a friend should resort to such a person. So that's lovely, isn't it? It's a very nice conclusion, nice verse at the end of it. So this is... important quality is, you know, the spiritual friend. And as I said, there are many different spiritual friends in our lives. Appreciating the good qualities in those we meet can be like a teaching for us, can be helpful for us. But of course, you know, in the end, the best spiritual friend, of course, one who's on the path. And that's the difficult thing, to meet someone like that. But we can investigate and see if they have those qualities, and then we may develop faith, then we may develop the energy, then we may put it into practice in terms of our morality, sila, precepts, then we may develop mindfulness, and then we may develop samadhi, the mind coming together, and we may develop wisdom. So this is a very important aspect of the Buddhist path, the whole of the spiritual life, this Kalyanamitta, but we have to choose wisely. So thank you for listening, and now there's just a brief amount of time. Sorry for going over there, but had a lot to say. It's a very important subject, and I enjoyed the last bit particularly, talking about Ajahn Brahm. Because this year, I don't know if you know, it's his 70th birthday this year, so it's a big year.
Are there any questions in the hall?
When's the lunch? It's coming soon.
There are a few online questions we can go to if no one else. I just wanted to read out a comment from someone, first of all, that just said, comment. Ajahn Brahm is also brave. Fearlessness is a glaring quality of an arahant.
Oh, what a good one. That's great. He's right. He is very brave. It's a bravery born of samadhi, though, I think. That single-mindedness gives one strength. It's very easier.
Thank you, Ajahn. I'll read the questions first that relate to the topic of today. Yep. So there's a question. Do you choose your spiritual friends, or do they just show up when you are ready?
Ah, that's a good question, isn't it? I think it's a bit of a combination, isn't it, really? You really only choose a spiritual friend when you're ready. You know, you have to have that readiness. The mind has to be ready for it. Whatever that condition is that's given rise to that readiness, dukkha, a burning question in our lives, some aspect that's really bringing up big questions. So then we're ready, yeah. We won't meet a spiritual friend until we're ready, really. That's it. Otherwise, we'll meet them and we'll think, oh, yeah, they're all right. Nice, okay. But it won't mean that much to one. We're not ready for it at that time.
If you're not ready, you can't see them.
Exactly, you can't see them. No, they'll just think, wow, that's, he's all right. So thank you for that. I hope it wasn't too...
I think that answers the question. Also, the next one that's also similar on the same topic of how do I make a spiritual friend, but I think that's really what the topic of the talk was about. It was about being ready.
Being ready.
And practicing your own qualities.
Yeah. Not being gullible, though. That's important.
So there are a couple of other questions which are just not related directly to the topic, but can Christians, Muslims and other non-Buddhists follow the Eightfold Path while still remaining as they are in a religious sense?
Uh-uh.
And if so, does it mean that non-Buddhists can attain liberation?
Right. Well, the Buddha said, he was asked, wasn't he, in the Parinibbana Sutta, I think it was by Subhadda, the last monk he ordained, actually, just before he passed away. Isn't it amazing? Working right up to the last moment. He was asked, is it possible for others in different traditions to become enlightened? And the Buddha replied, as I remember, it is possible for anyone who practices the Noble Eightfold Path to become enlightened, to awaken. So that is the condition, regardless of what background they've come from. If they practice that, then that will take them to enlightenment. I'm not quite sure how they'll mesh with right view. That's the only thing I find difficult, but maybe they, in some way they can reconcile some of the aspects of right view, because there's no place for a God in there as such in right view. But maybe they can. If they practice it, the Buddha said, it's possible to become enlightened. That's the path.
Thank you, Ajahn. And the last question here is, I meditate lying down. Sometimes gentle pulsing blue waves of light become visible.
Oh.
But sometimes I fall out of mental clarity. I'm wondering how to deepen my meditation at this point.
Right. If in that case, I think developing mental clarity, if there may be a reason for doing lying down meditation, some people find that physically they need to, but another way to develop clarity, of course, change the posture, obviously, to sit or walk if that's possible, and that will create more energy in the body. We're more likely to be more wakeful, because I know for myself, lie down and the body thinks, the mind thinks, well, time for sleep. But the point with lying down meditation is that we use a posture, a lying posture that we don't use for sleep. So if you sleep on your back, then if you lie down, if you're meditating, just to lie on the side, because it's less associated with sleeping. But changing the posture would be very a good way of doing it, sometimes taking a deep breath can bring one back to the present moment, increase clarity in the mind, reduce thinking. So there are possibilities. Yeah, so good. Yeah, thank you. So I think that's the last question. So thank you very much for listening to this online and in person. Isn't it nice? We can do it in person. And may you develop these connections for Kalyanamitta and also to appreciate the Kalyanamittas that are already in our lives that we don't appreciate and because they have qualities that we can learn from. So thank you very much. There we are. And now we can finish off by paying respects to those who'd like to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So there we are. It's always nice. Oh, this is the hard bit. Ooh.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhe vākhātho bhagavatā dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangham namami.